Hey there, my name's Jared Holt, and welcome to Shitpost. This is a podcast at the intersection of tech, politics, and culture. Every other Monday, I bring on someone who I think is doing interesting work or has an interesting perspective. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on the player of your choice and check out the newsletter on Substack. There's a link to that in the description. What's up, Shitpost listeners? This podcast is a day late. I have to apologize because I was traveling in Belgium for work. The DFR Lab hosted its 360 Open Summit conference in Brussels. It was pretty sick, but I would be lying if I said my body is still not recovering from the late nights out I had with my colleagues. But that's not what this episode's about. Joining the podcast this week, I have Ali Breland. Ali's a reporter at Mother Jones covering the internet, disinformation, hate, all kinds of things. If you've read the last couple of newsletters I've written, I've been feeling rather existential about the way we cover disinformation, extremism, and all that mess here in the US. I've been doing this for a hot minute now, and I have to say that not all the trends I've seen are great. A lot of progress has been made in this zone of coverage. That much I just consider a fact. But there still are miles to go in this space. Ali wrote a couple pieces in the last few weeks that gave me the impression that he's on a similar wavelength right now. Call it a vibe. I'll link to those pieces in the description of this episode, and trust me when I say that they are more than worth your time, especially if you cover or research extremism and disinformation online. But let's cut the jabber and just get right into it. What's up, Ali?
Hey, not much. Like you alluded to, I'm not feeling super stoked about the general direction of things, but I'm good otherwise.
Yeah, we're kind of on, like I said, on the same wavelength, on the same vibe as far as that goes. And I think right now, like even though these conversations are kind of difficult to have, and I'm sure this episode is not going to be, you know, the most optimistic kind of conversation, I think it's really important to have them, especially right now, before midterms creep up. And God forbid, if we think of 2024 and that election, it would be best to kind of get things sorted out and sort of try to think through these things before the clock starts ticking in a real and loud kind of way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. even though like the subject of the pieces that I've been writing about are sort of like, excuse me, I had COVID. Like a week and a half ago. So my throat's still clearing out. But yeah, even though those like pieces are, I guess, like sort of pessimistic, like I wrote about the, like, I guess like the fallacy of like echo chambers and like this like sort of quote unquote like doom cycle we're in, I do, I guess, like remain eternally optimistic about like the ultimate like direction that things will go in. But like more immediately, kind of like the people I cover, I have maybe increasingly taken like a short-term black pill, but I guess like capitulating and becoming like nihilistic is like not a long-term solution. So like I don't advise like anyone do that either. But yeah, like I don't know what things like resonated with you. Like I'm curious to know like what you saw in them.
Well, thankfully we have about half an hour to flesh that out, so let's dive into Perfect. It yeah. So yeah. Let's talk about that first piece you mentioned. It was published in Mother Jones. It's called Who Exactly is Trapped in an Echo Chamber? And that one resonated with me. You kind of revisited the way that people talk about the internet, the radicalization process, and specifically this use of the term echo chambers and kind of how it's deployed, particularly in mainstream press and like a mainstream political research setting. The idea was this, that social media is lumping people into these pockets online, and that's throwing people off the path. And I'm sure I've used the phrase echo chamber plenty of times in my career. But it's something that I've kind of tried to move on from in the last couple years, especially just because I don't think it's the right term to talk about how that sort of algorithmic sorting and social feedback loop of the internet works in practice. There was one part of that piece that I really enjoyed. I'll just read from it now, and you'll have to bear with me that I'm reading your writing right back to you. I know how that feels as a writer. But here we go. Echo chamber is a metacritique. It does not engage with the actual merits or flaws of an argument. Other people are simply deluded reactionaries, duped by Facebook. But while privately owned social media companies can influence us, they're hardly the only things that do. Our core ideologies and values are determined by everything from where we grew up, to whom we love, to the actual impacts of politics on our lives. Fixing Facebook won't solve the problem of many echo chambers, your family's opinions, your friends' bigoted talking points, even if it's a good idea. So first off, I guess let's talk about that, and maybe even before we talk about that, what made you want to write this piece? You've been covering disinformation and the far right and the kind of things we talk about on this show for a long time. Was there a moment of reflection that you remember where you thought, you know, I should write something about the way we talk about this, specifically how people use the term echo chamber?
The boring answer is that, like, my editor had developed this like front of the book column where like he wanted like 800 words and he was soliciting like different pieces on like terms that are in the sort of general vernacular that like maybe should be relitigated or interrogated in some way. Terms like, you know, ROI and like return on investment, how that's like become like a normal thing in our lexicon. And so like he came to me and I immediately like already had this set of terms in my mind that I don't know how like how I came to this, but eventually at some point, like there is this like class of like metacritique words like tribalism and to some degree like partisanship and echo chamber that are used by this like sort of pundit class that like I wrote don't actually they sometimes sidestep or obfuscate like actual problems and like try to take this sort of like voice of God position and like criticize other people's ideas not on the strength or the flaws of the ideas in and of themselves, but just by like the sort of like style that people get to these ideas with. And like, so a really easy example that I wrote about in the piece that like I came across is like I was just pouring through all the sort of like, or as much as I could have, it's infinite, so I couldn't do all of it, but like the literature and like people's writing on echo chambers. And I came across this Christoph column from like, I want to say it was like 2016 or something like that. Yeah, it was 2016. And
Christoph is a columnist for the New York Times.
Legendary. I think he's not like on staff technically still now, right? Because he like left to do that like political thing that didn't work out for some technicality.
Oh, he still writes for them. Yeah, that was him. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he's like bona fide staff. But
yeah, he like wrote this piece and he like has this example where he cites this study by Cass Sunstein that found that like when liberal judges happen to be temporarily placed on a panel with other liberals, they like usually swing leftward, he writes. And then the same holds true for conservative judges. He writes that it's the judicial equivalent of mob mentality. And then like he never proceeds to explain like why this is bad. And he's not the only person who operates like this. Like a lot of people think in these sorts of terms where like, if these ideas came to exist in a sort of like homogenous environment, then like they must necessarily be like sort of bad and like unnuanced. And I thought that that was like not good for a couple of reasons. One, like ideas can be bad that come about that way, but they might not be like the actual, like we can just go engage with the idea or like the policy itself to understand whether or not it's bad. And then it's also kind of rich given that like the sort of like conservative liberal binary is an echo chamber in and of itself, like the sort of like unique way that American politics is positioned, even though like resembles like other governments in the world, is still like its own form of echo chamber that excludes like a lot of other political possibilities that are considered like a foregone conclusion elsewhere. Just like the fact that we like, I don't know, have all sorts of debates over things that have like already litigated out or like refused to like engage with anything else is just like, I thought kind of silly. And also just was like a part of this sort of like, technocratic like pundit speak that like gets in the way of people actually like interrogating ideological and like merit of specific arguments.
Yeah, and I just want to like take a minute, at least what from I got from your piece, I didn't get that you were disputing that social media sites like Facebook, like Twitter, and the way content is sorted on them for the average user. Like, there's definitely a reinforcing effect that these sites can have on people as they're exploring ideology or consuming the news. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't get the sense that that is what you were arguing, right?
Yeah, like, they definitely can, and like, for certain people, and like, it would definitely be helpful to rectify like the worst harms and tendencies that these platforms produce. But like, I think that these sorts of issues, the echo chamber argument is like a sort of sub argument that like, of like a sort of larger thing I've been thinking about, which is that like, issues of disinformation like definitely need to be partially litigated through the platforms, but also like, there's just like a social fabric and framework that exists outside of it. And I think that like, disinformation festers and conspiracies fester and like, all of these things fester when there is like a climate of distrust in institutions, and like, climate of distrust partially fester from like, sort of like bad faith propaganda campaigns, but like, they can only thrive when they're being like, sort of activated and sitting on top of like, just bad conditions generally. Like, if the economy is not working for most people, if like, people are experiencing like various forms of precarity, like, they become like more willing to like engage with just like all sorts of like bad ideas that are not good for society, and they're willing to engage with like different things that are like not good for themselves. And like, social media is like a part of that, but I don't think that that's like the only thing that drives it. And I think that like, even if you solve these sorts of issues like on Facebook or whatever, you'd still have the issues like existing off platform. I think that thinking about disinformation conspiracy theories is like maybe best thought of in a sort of like very holistic like way. It's like a smattering of like complicated factors, and like, social media is one of them, but another one of them is also just like disenfranchisement, political disenfranchisement, and like precarity in the economy.
Yeah, there has to exist a certain degree of social disorder, I would think, for a lot of this stuff to catch on. You know, Steve Bannon, just to pull a name out of a hat here, he can go on his podcast, he can spread all kinds of conspiracy theories and misinformation, but, you know, he can broadcast that. I mean, that an algorithm on social media might even amplify it. But that alone doesn't make people believe it. That alone doesn't make people keep tuning into it. And echo chambers online do exist in a genuine sense, but I do think that, you know, the way that this gets talked about, or the way that phenomenon gets characterized, at least when it comes to these, you know, big mainstream columns in places like the New York Times or on some TV punditry, kind of overstates the scale, both of, you know, how many people might find themselves in it, and also to the degree that it is specifically a platform issue and not, you know, just that people, you know, have ideas or have a way of looking at the world and kind of end up self-selecting to some degree. But I think all of this gets to kind of a bigger issue, one that Joe Bernstein, with his essay in Harper's, we did an episode about it last year with him. It's something I think is worth revisiting here, which is that the language that we're using to talk about these issues, whether it is the far right, whether it is disinformation, platforms, whatever, something about it, and I am not a linguist, I am, you know, not an expert on this kind of question specifically, but it doesn't seem to be working. It doesn't seem like the message getting put out is as nuanced or as thorough as I think it deserves to be if we're actually going to grapple with the realities of those problems. You know, in your perspective, where do you think we're hitting walls here? I mean, echo chamber is one example of this, but do you agree that this is maybe kind of symptomatic of a larger problem in the way that we're having these kind of discussions?
Yeah. To maybe zoom out to like, and at the risk of being like slightly too broad, I think that like, this is a sort of problem that like replicates itself across fields. I think that, I don't know, maybe like this is like too far, but like, within like different fields, I think that like there's like a tendency to like drill down and be like, you know, and like sort of narrowly focus on like different issues being responsible for like being symptomatic of like all sorts of other different things. I think it's like a tendency in like psychology and economics to like find some specific niche and be like, this is like the problem. And I think that like disinformation, which is like a still a nascent field, is like experiencing its own versions of that as it grows, where like a sort of narrow focus that like drills down very hard on like very niche things and it's like ignores like the holistic experience of like how people process information in relation to their own like economic and racial positions, like affects like a number of things in their lives. And there are people who are like really good in this space who do sit down and think about these kinds of things. I think that like the Shorenstein Center at Harvard is like a good example of like maybe like a more complete, a group that like thinks more completely about different types of disinformation. But like thinking about things in these sorts of siloed terms like produces, I think, weird issues in just like any field. And like disinformation is like just like not different than that. There are fields that are already like sort of inadvertently dedicated to these kinds of things that like handle like questions of like epistemology, which is like something that disinformation also like grapples with, that are like sometimes ignored. And then there's just like other social conditions that exist outside of this that people don't want to engage with because they fear being seen as like politicizing disinformation. And like I understand like from a funding perspective like why you wouldn't want to do that, but like I don't know, you just can't like sidestep these things even if you have like other like noble or justified interests in sidestepping them.
Yeah, I mean it's a political problem. I think that, you know, this problem of disinformation requires political judgments to some degree at the very least, and I think it's kind of more honest to grapple with that. Certainly seems to me like something is being lost in translation here, and I guess my worry is that the general public, if you know, broader society, we live in a society, I had to say that at some point, you know, if broader society is getting the wrong idea about what these issues are, then it just kind of makes it that much harder to really grapple with them in a way that's going to be smart, that's not going to just, you know, get exploited by the worst people in the world to make the whole world a little bit worse and like degrade the quality of the internet.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just like recurringly like sits on top of itself and gets worse and worse and worse, like over and over. It is, I guess, like to augur like a different part of the conversation, like a bad cycle that like repeats itself in sort of like, I don't know, like not fun or good ways. Yeah.
Well, speaking of bad cycles, let's talk about this second piece that you mentioned. It's called Mass Shootings and Our Never-Ending Doom Cycle. In that piece, you wrote about the pattern of tragedy in the U.S. when it comes to mass shootings and what it's like to cover that. And again, I'm going to read another paragraph that you wrote back to you. So buckle up and bear with me, Ali. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'll do my best.
I don't even know how to write about these things anymore. I am paid to write about disinformation and extremism, things related to the culture wars, moral panics, and shootings motivated by the far right. But lately, I've started to feel like I'm rewriting versions of the same story, repeating the same plot line over and over again as the issues I'm covering actually seem to be moving backward. I felt like I was reading out of like the front of my own skull in that essay. I really liked it a lot for that reason, even though it made me feel fucking terrible reading it. I mean, often days I kind of look down at what I'm doing and, you know, I'm proud of my work. I think it's good quality. It's having good impact and all that. But in the broad scheme of things, this shit does keep happening. And as you said in the piece, it feels like it might just be getting worse. And I guess I wanted to hear about your own kind of personal fatigue of covering this stuff. I've certainly, you know, had my share of days, weeks, months, etc., where I have just felt, I forget what you said earlier, temporarily black-pilled, right? Describe what that's been like for you personally. And I also am curious sort of how you've sort of reckoned with that through the years, because I imagine this Uvalde shooting was not the first time you felt this way.
No, yeah, like one of the earliest times I sort of like felt this way was like, I forget what it was exactly, but it was like Marjorie Taylor Greene or some politician like of that stature did something. They said like something like egregious or like something that would like just fully have not been okay like a couple years prior. Like it would have, Republicans would have at the very least like had to have like performatively like rebuked this person and like censured them in some sort of way. And like the person would have like issued some sort of like apology or like at least performed contrition. Maybe they'd be sincere about it. I don't know. Maybe they weren't, but like there was like some sort of like at least like performance that had to happen. And then like in this instance, like it just didn't. Like the, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene or whoever, I mean, she's done like of this a number of times. So like, even if it wasn't her in that moment, she's also done it. But like the politician just like didn't back down at all. And it just doubled down on like whatever sort of like egregious, like sort of demoralizing position that they had that was like, I think like probably racist or something like that. And it was just like, now like calling these things out, like, no longer quite has an effect, and it's still like necessary and has to be done. But like there isn't even the sort of like pretense of shame that exists. And so like, that was like when I first started to feel these things, and I was like, this, there's like a futility sort of almost, to like writing about these things. And then it was like a different type of event, but like when the Uvalde shooting happened again, it was just like watching the same sort of like, forgive the trite metaphor, but like a Groundhog Day scenario where like immediately people start doing the same thing, as though it's like watching like a little play, and like a bunch of people who are like well-intentioned and like are probably doing the right thing, or like, you know, don't post the manifesto, and there's like tons of don't post the manifesto tweets, just what people do every time. And then other people started posting the on the media graphic about what happens in breaking news scenarios and how to like not spread disinformation, and it was like the same people that do it every single time. And then finally, like, you run through the other cycles of like where people were like calling for gun control and like ways to like try to stop this from happening, which again, like, they're not wrong in doing, but it's just like watching everyone take their little roles and like repeat out everything over and over, and then watching it like butt up against the fact that like nothing clearly like is going to happen. There isn't anyone who is like in positions of power that are like dedicated to have like a clear way to like rectify these problems. And it was just like watching this like doom cycle, is the term I used, like play out again and again and again. And so like, even though shootings are like very different than like sort of like public displays of like racism or endorsing like white supremacy, to me, they felt like a part of this like broader thing where like we've reached this like intractable point where like these bad things that like we have already like sort of like accepted as a society, or had accepted at one point to be like not okay, are just like going to persist, and like nothing will happen, and there's like no clear way to like solve them, at least in the interim. I think that like solving these like large intractable issues can seem like impossible in the short term, and can be impossible in the short term, but that doesn't mean that like, I don't know, like averting them in the long term is like impossible. But like right now, it just, it feels like there is like nothing to be done. And I can't blame people for feeling like blackpilled themselves, because like, I guess I almost am starting to.
Yeah. I was just about to ask if you thought that same kind of fatigue that, you know, you feel, that I admittedly feel sometimes, makes its way to readers or the general public. I once wrote this essay for the newsletter associated with this podcast about what I worried was, I used the term bystander effect, happening in U.S. democracy, that people look at, you know, the state of affairs of the country, see all this terrible shit happening, don't feel like there's anything they can do about it, or that, you know, oh, maybe it's the news is the problem, or maybe it's just, you know, what is one person going to do? And you end up with this collective experience of bystander effect, where people don't do anything because they feel like there's nothing to do. I was wondering if that's something you've thought about, or if you have any thoughts about that.
That kind of reminded me, like you say, I don't know, it makes me think about the sort of like people who demand like voting as like a way out of this, which like, again, I think that like, you know, I'm pro democracy, like voting towards like resolving solutions is like not a bad instinct, but like people have been told this before, and like it doesn't like seem to produce anything clear. And it's just like, you know, what is the answer if like people can keep voting and there's like not steps towards like meaningful solutions? And like, I don't know, like I guess like in some ways, I don't want to say that it like represents like the limits of electoral politics, but maybe it like does, maybe it does, or maybe it like represents like the limits of like the sort of like contradictions and the barriers of like the current system and its like specific manifestation. Like the fact that like, I guess like, you know, there is, we are governed by like a sort of like gerontocracy who like, for whatever reason is like set in a sort of like predisposed positions that for whatever reason, like maybe they are intractable. Maybe they've just decided that they're intractable, but like have become like intractable and immutable. We're just like kind of sitting on them and watching them. Like, I don't, people feel disenfranchised. They feel like bystanders, and like, I don't know, like they're right to feel like that, in that like, there's not like a clear way out. I don't know.
Well, you know, besides that kind of bystander effect, or besides just feeling, you know, almost impotent in a political system where we're supposed to all want to participate, are there any other issues that, you know, kind of stand out to you about the presence of this, you know, kind of infinite doom loop that the United States seems to be caught up in?
I guess like the things that need to be like handled from it are like, if like there is to be a way out of the system, like it would require, I guess, like restructuring the system in the ways that, I don't know, like looking at things like gerrymandering and like, I guess like the filibuster that like get in the way of like whichever party's in power ruling in the way that they like see fit. It's like, I don't know, I guess like these stalemates that like occur are like OP, the video game term, like overpowered towards like conservatism, and like seem to get in the way of like what happens when people elect people on the left. If that makes sense, like I guess like to try to like condense that, like when like conservatives win, like they get what they want, but then when liberals win, conservatives kind of also get what they want by being able to produce stalemates, because like that is inherent to the conservative position. So like the structure of democracy as it is, like will favor conservatism in a way that it like shouldn't, even when they're being like not voted into office. And so like it seems like something would need to change in that way to like get like a more accurate form of democracy and like allow people access to the solutions that they want, ostensibly, that's like showing up in polls that they want. I don't know, that's like maybe kind of convoluted. Does that get at what you're asking, or like?
Yeah, no, I think so. It's like disparaging almost.
Kind of, yeah. I don't know. Is that like kind of what you mean when you like talk about like the bystander like effect being produced? Is that like what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Where like people might just feel like they shouldn't do anything. Because why would they?
Yeah. I don't know. Like moneyed interests, I guess, like exist above all of us in a way that like is like very hard to fight like people with a lot of money. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. It's very demoralizing.
Well, all of this has been pretty gloomy. I'll be real about that with listeners. I do want to try to end things here on a hopeful note, though it's not the easiest thing to do in the world with a conversation like this. And regarding that kind of conversation, I just want to be explicit here, especially to other people who do the kind of research and reporting that I do, that Ali does. I know a lot of folks in the field listen to the show. These conversations are difficult and sad, and it's exactly why I think we need to have them, and particularly sooner rather than later. And that's why I chose this week to have Ali on to talk about some of those pieces. So, two questions, I guess, real quick. One related to each of those pieces. You know, you wrote that piece about how echo chambers, or at least the way echo chambers are described in, you know, big bastions of mainstream press, are probably not, you know, a thing. At least not in the way that they're talked about, right? But it is probably good that we know that now, that we understand that now, at least the more thoughtful people in this field. And at least from my perspective, like, in its own way, like, the silver lining here is that in itself is maybe a sign of progress, right? It's like maybe a sign that conversations are moving forward. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that, like, the one echo chamber that I would like to, like, turn itself and like I guess like have eyes on itself would be, this is like a little trite, but I do think that, like, not even like the coast, but like DC specifically, I think has like a weird view of politics that is like more insular and like more echo chambery than like a lot of other places. Like, for whatever problems, like, I don't know, people in like suburban Texas where I'm from, or like, I don't know, I like know people and like have friends out in like rural Tennessee or places like that, for whatever like problems you think that like of insularity those political people, those people have in their politics, which are probably accurate. Like they do have like an awareness of like a world that exists here in like a way that I think like is not mirrored. I think that like, I don't think that people there have necessarily better politics than people in DC, but like they understand the politics of people in DC, I think, better than the other way around. And I think that like, I don't know, just like that is like, yeah, an echo chamber that like, I guess like I would like people to like, I don't know, think about, but like, yeah, I guess it's just like, I don't know. I don't really have anything beyond that.
And the vicious doom loop, is there any sort of reason to be optimistic? And I just want to say straight up, it is totally okay to just say no to this question.
Yeah, because like it's easy to like feel like things aren't going to change, and in like some ways they won't, but they're like also have historically been periods that like do show us like a glimpse of like what things could look like. Like for a separate doom loop is just like the doom loop of like racial politics, and like, you know, us going through like multiple cycles of like huge racial justice protests that like don't amount to much. But at the same time, like there have been periods of like brief reprieve, not like, you know, solving racism, but like of moments where like Black people did have, I guess, like more access to the halls of like political power in moments of the country before, I guess like the club of racism was like struck down and like things were reversed through like things like the New Jim Crow and incarceration, things like that. So like there are moments that like have existed over the course of history that like can show us like, I guess, a better version of a future that we would all agree is more just and like are possible. And like it's just about like catching those like flashes in a pan and like making them more permanent. So I look to those personally, like for hope and optimism.
And as we're coming up on the end of things here, I have one more question for you. Every guest on the show gets this question. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
I it always is like flipping. I don't have like a great answer right now. I think it's like, I really enjoy two things. The general, like the Selectuals meme accounts. I think that like the trend towards like hyper specific meme accounts has been like really funny and like entertaining. And like, I don't know. It's like, I heard like someone talk once about how like NPR is like really comforting for like homesickness, because like you get to listen to like people talk about traffic on the roads from where you're from. But I like my version of that is like listening to people or like watching people shitpost about like, I don't know, like niche bars in like the Houston area. And then there's this other guy I've been really enjoying on the internet. His name is like Bo Daddy Harris. And he is this like, I think he's from like Kentucky or something, but he's this guy who like, he's not famous or anything, but he has like the most incredible baritone voice. And like, I don't know, has just like a very interesting like outlook on the world. And like, I think semi inadvertently produces like, I don't think he means to create like experimental music, but is creating like really good, like experimental country and like soul music that is just like, it's super trippy. And is like the only, is like a thing that could like only exist on the internet, because this guy would like not get like looks from labels or anything like that. Or at least like in a different time, he wouldn't have.
Well, thanks for coming on. I've been talking with Ali Breland, reporter at Mother Jones. Check out a link to, I'll put Ali's Twitter, some of the recent pieces he's written, and a link to that experimental country music you're talking about. Now I'm really intrigued. I'll put all that down in the description. Ali, thanks so much for joining this week.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.